Bronwyn, where are you? There you are.
Yep.
So,
Hi. Hi, for anybody who doesn't know me, I'm Bronwyn Haskell. I'm the chair, co-chair of the Social Justice Committee. And this is the first program, I guess, put on by the Anti-Racism Task Force. A lot of the members are here tonight. And we've been meeting, we formed out of the book circle that we had over the summer, where we read, had several groups reading Me and White Supremacy. And then we had a meeting around Rosh Hashanah, a more synagogue-wide meeting to discuss anti-racism and how Cane Street can start to develop as an anti-racist institution. So a small group of us has been meeting ever since then. And now here we are at another one of those points in the year where we're beginning again and refocusing. And we thought that Passover was a good time with the Exodus story to kind of examine our modern relationship with racial justice. And so our rabbis are going to do that tonight. And also Rabbi Bera Elman, who's also a member of the task force. And if anybody here after tonight, if you want to get more involved or find out more about what we're doing, you can email socialjustice@canestreet.org. We can get you involved. Oh, Flora's here.
Okay. So we're going to start with a little warm up, an activist song. And it's actually kind of one that it can go on forever. We're not going to go on forever, but it's called "I Went Down to the Courthouse," and you can change courthouse to different things. So each of the people on the panel is going to throw out another location for each verse, and if we don't get one that I'm really hoping for, then I'll close out with the last one. Otherwise, we'll just go with those five. So here it goes. You'll catch on very quickly. I went down to the courthouse and I took back what they stole from me, and I took back my dignity, and I took back my humanity, and it's under my feet, under my feet, under my feet, and gonna let nobody walk all over me.
I'm throwing out to you, Barra, the schoolhouse.
I went down to the schoolhouse and I took back what they stole from me, and I took back my dignity, and I took back my humanity, and it's under my feet, it's under my feet, under my feet. I'm gonna let nobody walk all over me.
How about the jailhouse?
Great. I went down to the jailhouse and I took back what they stole from me, and I took back my dignity, and I took back my humanity, and it's under my feet, under my feet, under my feet, and gonna let nobody walk all over me.
I'm gonna throw out Grand Army Plaza.
Well, I went down to Grand Army Plaza. I took back what it stole from me, and I took back my dignity, and I took back my humanity, and it's under my feet, under my feet, under my feet, and gonna let nobody walk all over me.
How about workplace?
Well, I went down to the workplace and I took back what they stole from me, and I took back my dignity, and I took back my humanity, and it's under my feet, under my feet, under my feet, and gonna let nobody walk all over me.
Trump Plaza.
I went down to Trump Plaza and I took back what they stole from me, and I took back my dignity, and I took back my humanity, and it's under my feet, under my feet, under my feet, and gonna let nobody walk all over me. Here's the last one. And I went down to Pharaoh's pyramids, and I took back what they stole from me, and I took back my dignity, and I took back my humanity, and it's under my feet, under my feet, under my feet. I'm gonna let nobody walk all over me. Right, you should clock everybody. So I'm going to start out with a little kind of framing of why we thought Passover was a particularly important time to begin our public face of the Anti-Racism Task Force, and hopefully our synagogues, our congregations, entry into sort of some self-reflection, education, and action that will help us to become an anti-racist community. And the reason that I thought, in addition to the Exodus story itself, is that Passover marks the commemoration of our foundation as a people. Exodus 12 begins with the line, "This month will be for you the first of months, the first month of the year." It's essentially God saying, telling Moses to tell the Israelites, tonight is the first day of the rest of your life. From this point forward, you are a people with me. And it's that people who then leave Egypt in the Exodus, leave the degradation, and are going to go to redemption. But they don't go alone. The Bible tells us also that a mixed multitude comes with them. So we have already a diversity that we need to celebrate. But even beyond that, in the 2,000 plus years since the original Exodus, quote unquote, we have grown as a people. People have entered and joined the Jewish people from all over the globe. People of all sorts of backgrounds and cultures and traditions. And so we can really celebrate that foundation, this new foundation of a real diversity that we can celebrate. And also to recognize that there are a variety of oppressions experiences that this new community remembers. The oppression of American chattel slavery, for example, the oppressions of exploitation of workers, the oppression of an unjust medical healthcare system, which disproportionately affects people of color. So it's with that idea in mind that our identity formation, our identity, recognizing our identity as a diverse community, you know, rather than an insular community, and thinking of Passover as a chance to be sort of our family, to remember that our family is actually exceedingly broad and diverse. And with that, each of us is going to give you some tips for ways to embellish certain parts of the Haggadah. And we're gonna each take a section. Obviously it's not comprehensive, but it will be sections of the Haggadah. And then at the end, we'll come back and talk a little bit about Haggadahs that you might explore.
I'm gonna share my screen. Rabbi Val, if anyone tries to enter, can you let them in and on? So let me. Okay. Okay. Everyone sees my screen?
Yeah.
Okay, yep. Great. All right, so as Barra was mentioning, certainly the Passover story, our source for that, of course, is the Exodus, right? The book of Exodus. And that's where our narrative begins and where our Passover story takes from. So when it comes to the Seder, our source turns to the rabbis, and really the Mishnah, it becomes the primary source, and particularly Mishnah Pesachim and chapter 10, and particularly within that work, is really where we get what is basically the elements of the Seder as we now practice it. It's evolved since then, but basically a lot of the elements are basically there, and that's really where we begin. So I'm going to begin with Karpas, and I thought that would be, again, starting from this source would be a good place to kind of have us begin. So if maybe we'll do a little Seder style, Rachel, if you don't mind, maybe right. You can read this little.
Okay, sure.
Okay.
I guess it's supposed to be they,
Yes, sorry.
Or then, maybe they or them. Then bring them before the Seder leader. The leader dips the chazaret before getting to the matzah. They bring matzah, chazaret, haroset, and two cooked items representing the Passover offering and the festival offering. Our practice is to use a shank bone and a roasted egg. Haroset is not an obligation, excuse me, though Rabbi Eliezer Bar Tzadok says that it is an obligation. In the temple, they used to bring the Passover offering to be eaten.
Okay, so this should sound somewhat familiar in that, you know, we're basically getting all the items that make up our Seder plate are being brought to a table. But first, we get this part that I bolded, which is that, as you said, it should say, they bring them or they bring it before the Seder leader, and the leader dips the chazeret before getting to the matzah. So that's the matzah that you're going to begin to tell the story of Passover with. But before that, before you get to those, what would be maybe kind of the Seder plate items, although matzah now isn't a Seder plate item, maybe it was at this point. We have this beginning of the chazeret. So just to give us the context, the teaching right before this is, we've said our holiday kiddush. So just like we would do on Shabbat or on a holiday, usually we would say kiddush, and then we would say a blessing on what food, what is unusual about this activity that's happening here, or this blessing? What's the food we would usually turn to and bless?
Bread.
Exactly, bread. That's how we begin. But here, we're saying a blessing over chazeret. So why is that? So there's a few answers. One would be the entire Passover Seder is very much kind of a, you know, bringing of the Greek symposium of that experience to the story of Passover. And that's kind of how the entire structure in the Seder was arranged to have that experience. So this really becomes, you know, the appetizer section, which is something that we certainly do. It's kind of been our practice for quite a while, is after saying the blessing that's there for a pre-adama, we have a full section of appetizers so that we can begin to get some food as we begin to then tell the Passover story. But here, so that would be one element. The other element would just be, as I just asked you, like, what's unusual going on? The Talmud actually says the reason that we do this is to provoke questions, particularly from children. So they would say, you know, kids would say, what's going on? How come we're not doing the blessing on the bread? That's usually how we start. And the whole idea is that you set up the idea that Passover and the Seder is all about asking questions. So it kind of begins that process at the earliest point. So that's another way of looking at it. And then the final one we're going to move on from is, it introduces symbolism and metaphors into the entire experience, which obviously is what the Seder plate really does. But this is kind of an early example of that as we build into that to kind of begin to have our mind think that way. So with that, we're going to look at what are the symbols of this step, and how can we work them again as we lead into this particular year and thinking about bringing racial justice into the Seder. So what's the vegetable? So what did it just tell us is the vegetable that we're supposed to be using?
Karpas.
No, not karpas.
No, chazeret.
Chazeret, exactly. So what is chazeret?
Where's karpas, right?
Karpas does not appear at all in the Mishnah. That language doesn't appear later on, exactly. So what is chazeret? Chazeret is lettuce or some sort of wild lettuce. Later, also, chazeret becomes associated with horseradish. So some people literally use the word chazeret, which is not, it's really lettuce, to also mean a horseradish. So what connects these two things?
Bitterness.
They're both potential, yes, bitterness. Who just said that? I can't see you because I can only see people. So they're both potentially bitter, right? So the idea is, what would be a lettuce you would use that's bitter?
Arugula.
Arugula is a good one. I agree. That would be one that we would probably use more likely now. But one of the more traditional ones is
Romaine.
So that's one that's used. And there's even the idea here. This is a, you know, if you're into gematria a bit, here's karpas broken up into samech, which can mean 60 or 600,000, And then if you rearrange the rest of the letters from it, perech, which is used for like avodat perech, hard labor. So the idea is that the karpas is supposed to be bitter, which isn't how we necessarily associate it now with how most of us eat it. So that's, again, it's connecting the karpas, not karpas, but chazeret, with when else do we have chazeret during the Seder? Some of us, or some people.
Dipping into the maror.
Exactly.
The Hillel sandwich.
Exactly. So it connects the maror with the chazeret at this stage. And it even says, here's a piece on the Mishnah Berurah, which says, when you're saying the blessing on karpas, berei pri adama, you should actually be thinking about maror that you're going to eat later on. So there's this direct connection between the two, even at that point. And then when we say the four questions, when we say, you know, we don't dip shebecho halilot in anu matbilim afilu pa'am echat, alayla hazeh shetei pa'amim, what are the two times? These are the two dippings that you're doing. One at the beginning with the karpas, and then later in the meal when you're doing the dipping into the maror. So that would be one vegetable choice. Here's the second vegetable choice. Maybe you can give me this, Nathan, since you mentioned, where's karpas? Give us this reading.
Okay. And why or what is karpas? The word karpas derives from the Greek karpos, meaning the fruit of the soil. The historical origins of dipping karpas at the Seder reflect the accepted cuisine of the Greco-Roman symposium. Better calling karpas the spring vegetable, it represents both the historical birth of Israel out of the womb of Egypt and the rebirth of nature renewed each spring. According to Philo and Rabbi Joseph, the original birthday of nature, the creation occurred at Pesach time, not Rosh Hashanah. Similarly, the Italian name for spring, primavera, and the French,
primavera.
Oh boy, have you got something here? Preserve some of the return to the original first time of the world. Spring, Old English, is originally applied to the place of origin which the steam arises. Later, steam it is applied to the season, the spring of the year. What a different Haggadah.
Yeah, which is a very nice Haggadah, which has. So if you were thinking of spring, what green might you use? What do you think it is probably the most symbolic one related with?
Parsley? Green?
Parsley, exactly. So we have two choices. You can use a bitter one, a very bitter one, meaning romaine, or we have a different green, which is I would call, parsley is not technically sweet, but it's a lot less bitter than romaine, and it's the most spring-like. So that's the vegetable. Now, what about the dip? So what does the Mishnah tell us to dip into? I'm going back to the Mishnah now. What does the Mishnah actually say about your dipping? It doesn't say. That's right, Rachel. It just says you dip the chazeret. It doesn't explain what you dip into. So the contextual understanding for most people or for most understanding is either water or vinegar. That became, for most people, I think, how many people today use salt water in your karpas? It's probably the most prevalent. But here we have a teaching from others, including Maimonides, who say you actually dip into charoset. So they dip this section into charoset, not into water. And some people still have that practice, I understand, as well. I don't know if anyone... We'll do a quick look if anyone on here now has that practice. No, I never did either. But that's another practice. So if you were to use the romaine lettuce, the bitter lettuce, and dip it into the sweet charoset, or you're going to use the spring parsley and dip it into the salt water, what you're doing in each case is mixing the bitter and the sweet, or the joy and the sadness. And that, again, at this most earliest stage of the Seder, then sets up that theme, that motif that runs throughout, which is that we're both, you know, moving towards freedom or the hope of freedom, but at the same time, very, you know, either thinking back about the time we were in slavery or the fact that others are still enslaved in some way, or maybe we are still enslaved in some way. So it brings both of those. So the last part I'm going to do before we get to the, you know, how we can turn this into a particularly, I think, meaningful ritual to think about it in terms of the movement towards racial justice is the actual dipping. So let's get one more person to read this dipping piece. Who can I have read it? Amy, would you like to read the Exodus piece about the dipping?
Sure. And then if we have time, I have one comment that I learned about Chazeret, but I'll save that. So from Exodus, take a bunch of hyssop, dip it into the blood that is in the basin, and apply some of the blood that is in the basin to the lintel and to the two doorposts. None of you shall go outside of the door of his house until morning.
Okay, so what we're doing, this is now we're going back to the Exodus text, and you're literally taking the green, and what they were doing is they were dipping it into the blood and then putting it, that's what they would use to put the blood onto the doorpost of their home in order for the Passover to take place so that they would not be smite like the other people in the land of Egypt. So one more, read that part at the bottom here. Actually, I'll just read it. Here's an interpretation of that from a Pesach Haggadah from Germany, which is the dipping of karpas alludes to two opposing ideas, subjugation and freedom. First, it symbolizes subjugation when our lives were like the vinegar or the salt water. And in the end, it symbolizes the merit of dipping the hyssop when we fulfilled the commandment of placing the blood on the doorposts of our homes so that Israel was saved from the death of the firstborn and afterwards they went forth to freedom. So you're literally, right, in this ritual, capturing both of those pieces. So for me, at this particular time, thinking about how this particularly applies to, I think, as an American, and the closest thing in my life to experiencing and knowing people who have perhaps gone through a life of slavery and is, you know, a deep part of our country is obviously the Black American experience and the experience of slavery that we had here. And it's not just thinking back about it, but it's recognizing, like I said, that this is almost like an ongoing cycle of progress and setbacks. Progress and setbacks. So we're not really at the point of freedom yet. It's the hope of freedom. And it's knowing that it's not such a clear narrative where you're enslaved and suddenly free, but actually an ongoing process of actually getting to freedom that includes freedom, subjugation, progress, setback. So with that in mind, I tried to, you know, construct different points in time of thinking about the Black American experience and our movement towards racial justice. So here you have, for example, subjugation, 1619, when slaves first are brought over from Africa. About 1808, Congress bans further importation of slaves, and you have some of the Underground Railroad. 1850, though, you have Dred Scott, and you have Congress does not have the right to ban slavery in states. Soon after, what do we have? The Civil War. And the Emancipation Proclamation, eventually slavery is ended and we have Reconstruction, but of course, not soon after, what happens? Reconstruction ends, right? And then we get a setback once again, where then we have an institution of Jim Crow laws. And and then I included in here the Great Migration, which is both, I guess you would consider a part exodus, but not a full movement or freedom for Black Americans by any means, but at least a freeing of perhaps the most abusive situation for many of them. And then once again, we move forward, you would have things like Plessy versus Ferguson, where racial segregation is ruled constitutional. And then of course, later on, that's overturned with Brown versus Board of Education. So for me, what I was trying to sort of construct here is this idea that as we do karpas, you could perhaps either, you know, as you dip, think about or mention a few of these as examples of us moving towards freedom, but understanding that subjugation has been a part of this ongoing cycle there, and is probably going to, you know, continue, but hopefully for not much longer. what we all hope for as part of the Passover Seder, is that we're bringing that day of freedom closer for everyone. That was my
Can I ask a question about that, Jason?
Yeah, sure. I know, do we want to do questions now, or do we want to go through the different teachings and then leave time at the end? Maybe one or two questions, is that right?
Well, I just was so shocked by the thing about putting the blood on the lintels, and I'm just wondering, are people who actually do that, or even, I don't know where they would get blood, but it's...
No.
Do people put anything? Do people go out to their doorposts? Is that something that is done in this day and time?
I've never heard of that practice myself, of anyone going quite that experiential with trying to, you know, recreate it. But
Okay.
I'd like to make a point of information, though.
Yes.
I'm well aware that in Israel, that sheep are slaughtered on the 14th of Nisan. As a ritual related to the Karban Pesach, I would not be surprised if blood were put on doorposts as a symbolic recreation.
Right.
But I can guarantee you that that practice of slaughtering a sheep is done today.
Samaritan communities, and yeah.
I will ask my Hasidic nephew in Jerusalem if they do anything like that.
I'm going to suggest that we try to hold questions till the end, because so maybe even make a note for yourself if you have a question, because then we can have a larger discussion.
Can I make a comment that just directly relates to what Jason said?
Your grandfather, because you asked this question earlier, and so you do get to. Your question is grandfather. Go ahead.
Oh. Well, it's just a quick comment, which is something that I was learned at one point about Chazeret, which is what I was told is that if you do this, you eat romaine lettuce because it has it's a little bit of a flip, but fits in with what you're saying, Jason, that it actually starts off as sweet and then becomes bitter as you keep eating it. And it supposedly symbolizes the Israelites' experience in Egypt, where they started off coming once Jacob brought everybody over and Joseph had paved the way, that it started off as sweet and then it became, their lives were more bitter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's all.
Thank you. We're going to move along the Seder. Our next step is?
Avadim Chayinu and Rabbi Sam.
Oh, okay. Hi. Let me go back. Hi. Okay. Good evening, everybody. So I'm going to do a little, first of all, I want to thank Rabbi Jason, a really good presentation, first of all, but also for setting me up a little bit, because he looked at Pesachim 10.3, and I'm going to bring in, the Pesachim, the tractate, and the Mishnah 10.4. It's a very interesting chapter in the tractate, because although it is true, as Barra said earlier, and as we all know, the Seder is extremely flexible in terms of what you can do, and there's very little kind of strict halakha around it. But on the other hand, the Talmud goes into incredible detail about all the different steps. And it's rare to take like a home ritual and have it laid out so much in a classic text, especially the Talmud. So it's interesting. Anyway, so I'm going to look a little bit at something which is dealt with in the next Mishnah, after the one that Rabbi Jason talked about. But first, I want to talk about something that I've always done at my own Seder, and I encourage for yours. And that is, you know, I like to encourage people to think about something beforehand, to ask themselves questions beforehand, so that people are sort of broadly speaking sharing a bandwidth together, and there'll be sort of meta questions, if you will, that can enrich the Seder. So I try to do that. And at the end of this little talk that I'm going to give, I'm going to suggest some related to the issues of racial justice today. But I wanted to set that by way of the context of what I'm going to try to do now. And the part that I want to read, I'm not really looking very much at a ritual or even a text. And so it's mainly like a consciousness to have as we go about the Seder and try to relate it to the issue of racial justice. But the paragraph or so that I'm going to talk about, it's not even entirely relevant, but how can I put it? There's an argument in the Talmud in the 3rd century between two great rabbis. Some of you may have known about this, Rav and Shmuel. They were arguably the greatest Talmudic rabbis of the third century. And the Mishnah, this is in Pesachim, right after what Rabbi Jason taught, tells us, Matchil Bignut U'Misayim B'Shevach, that when you go through the Seder, a person should begin with degradation and conclude with praise. Basically, you begin on sort of a, you look at the hard stuff first, and you end on a note of celebration. So in terms of your mood, your reflection, emotionally, it's moving up through the Seder, right? In our language, we would say in Hebrew, me'abdut l'chayrut, from slavery to freedom is the way we put it. So that has to be the overall arc of the Seder. Now, what does that mean? So these two great rabbis had different ideas. Shmuel said, well, that means we have to talk about the Exodus from Egypt, where we were first slaves, and then we were freed. And Rav disagreed. He said, no, what we want to talk about is, what we have to talk about is the fact that we were originally idolaters. We were, you know, immersed in polytheistic cultures, and eventually we found the true God, and we were found by that true God, and that's what we should celebrate. And so we have in the Haggadah, there are really two, and out of its great sort of respect for what we would call today pluralism, the Haggadah, whoever put this original Haggadah together, decided to respect both opinions. We have this paragraph at the beginning, Abadim Hayino the Pharaoh. We were slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt, and God, our Lord, took us out of there with a strong hand and an outstretched arm. So that honors the opinion of Shmuel, who said that we should focus on the liberation from Egypt, if you will, a physical liberation. And a few minutes later, however long it takes you in your Magid, we get to Mitrila Avdeim, our ancestors first served idols, but now God brought us close to God, as it is written, and so forth. Okay, Maimonides actually had a very interesting understanding of these. Maimonides said that actually, when they're talking about Gnut and Shevach, he felt that Shmuel, when Shmuel was talking about physical liberation, he was talking about the way you should teach the Seder to kids. The young people, because young people, they understand Pharaoh is very evil and slavery is bad. You shouldn't hurt other people and imprison them. And then God came along, all these great miracles. So you talk to young people that way. But when you're talking about spiritual liberation, if you will, what it means to go from a confining myth, a myth which believes that we don't have any choice in the world, a myth which is based on fate, a myth which can justify hierarchies and so forth and slavery, and you move towards a myth where, as we believe, God tells us that people are evil, are equal, and you have to free the slave and so forth, that is a change of consciousness, which is an adult discussion, basically. So he said that focusing on the physical aspect is more for children, on the spiritual aspect is more for adults. So, okay, so I was thinking about this year in terms of racial justice. There's something that happened to America watching like the murder of George Floyd, which I thought, I mean, it was unbelievably profound, and I'm still trying to understand really what happened. Yes, we saw a black man being murdered by a white police officer. Okay, I get that. We also know that that's happened before, and there were other cases before, but there was something in that event that sort of like cracked the consciousness of our country open in a certain way. And I think, to me at least, and others may have different ideas, but to me there was a level of absolute humiliation of that human being, which violated so much, you know, what we feel basically just as human beings when another human being suffers. I mean, forget their race or their nationality or whatever. There was something so deeply violative about it. And so it connects me to these two things about physical liberation and spiritual liberation, because I think America, I hope and I think that America got much more attuned, not just to the murder and physical oppression of black people, but to the humiliation that people of color feel in this country just walking around the streets. And that, I think, was a real a turning point that took an incredible tragedy for it to be broken up more. But I think that was a change, and it to me, it relates to this whole discussion of physical freedom spiritual freedom, etc. Because I think and I hope that we got to really understand, you know, on a deeper psychological and spiritual sense, the experience of African Americans and people of color in this country. The other thing which I wanted to bring in related to this, and so the rabbis talk about this, by the way. You know, there's a great midrash, which I noted here. I brought it into a writing, which I think I shared with the congregation right after George Floyd was murdered. Actually, it was around Eric Gardner's time I brought this in. But anyway, the rabbis talk about the when the brothers sell Joseph, right, which set up the whole slavery, of course. The brothers sell Joseph, and you remember the story? They stripped off his coat, ketutanto, and they threw him in the pit. And the rabbis point out that, you know, before you enslave somebody, first you humiliate them. You have to sort of, you try to diminish so much their sense of self and their self-image and who they are and the way other people think of them. And that's what stripping them. They could have just thrown them in with the coat, you know. But I know they had to take the coat and get it bloody for the father. But this is another interpretation. So there's a level of, I think, spiritual oppression, which I hope we've become sensitive to this past year. And a level of, if you will, apart from just the physical oppression, you know, the scars that people of color are subject to, the assaults of dignity just walking around the streets. I am very, there were a few essays which Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel wrote in the 60s, and he wrote them to white people. One was actually called The White Man on Trial. And Heschel to this day, I mean, I know it happened 60 years ago, but one of the things I love about him is that, you know, he had just incredible, I think he has this incredible sensitivity, not just into the heart and mind of the perpetrator, you know, the Ku Klux Klan or whatever, but to, if you will, to the bystander. Like, what is it like for a white person of basically good conscience to try to turn on the TV and see this happening to another human being? And so I wanted to just share with you, before my suggestion about the Seder, some of basically Heschel, in one speech, he analyzes the shame and the guilt that good people, of white people and people who are not of color, feel when they see the mistreatment of black people. And he says that there are six ways that you can deal with a bad conscience. That when you see something which is horrifying, when you see another human being degraded like that, there are six ways, Heschel says, you can deal with it. He says, one, you can extenuate the responsibility. Two, you can keep the victims out of sight. Three, you can alleviate your qualms by pointing to the progress that has already been made. Four, you can delegate responsibility to the courts. Five, you can cultivate indifference, just sort of quiet your conscience down. And finally, he says, and he's being kind of sarcastic here, he says, you can dedicate the mind to issues of a far more sublime nature. And here I think he was really talking to a clergyman, especially white clergy people, who were telling their activist clergy people to quiet down. You know, this is not the kind of, that politics is not what the church or synagogue gets involved in, et cetera. You know, what we should be doing is treating people's souls, treating matters of a sublime nature, right? This is this argument. So I think that it's really relevant even today. We tend to do these things, and I do them myself, frankly, because it's so hard sometimes just to deal with the level of inequality and seeing it expressed so violently. But I think we should be aware of what we can do, aware of what we do, and also aware that we can become more conscious of it and alleviate it or work on it. And so as consciousness raising, I would urge basically three questions which you might want to think about and invite your guests to think about before the Seder. The first one was a little bit as I shared tonight, you know, what new understanding of the struggle of people of color in this country have you learned since Passover last year? That's, I think, an important question. And there's no right or wrong answer. You listen to whatever people bring forward. The second one is, you know, basically what new questions do you have this year. And again, you should encourage honesty at the Seder. So there are no good questions or bad questions or politically correct questions or incorrect questions. But what new questions do you have this year? And thirdly, you know, upon reflection, what do you think, you know, keeps you back, you know, keeps you locked in despair or powerlessness or whatever it is, as you try to be an effective ally? And I think those would be good questions to think about. Thank you.
Ashokoa.
That's a great segue for me, actually, because I'm going to introduce you to some material from the Haggadah that I made. And one of the things that I also do, or Jay and I also do at our Seder, is we always assign homework ahead of time. 2 weeks was a similar kind of thing to get people thinking in a certain contemporary meaningful orientation for what's going to happen. So I'm going to depart a little bit from what Rabbi Jason and Rabbi Sam have just done with their looking at older sources and turn to this idea of the flexibility of the Haggadah. Kind of like a Jewish wedding, where basically there is very little that you actually have to do and everything else is up to the bride and groom and his culture and festival and whatever. Similarly with Passover, there are some fixed things you have to do, and then there's a lot of room for embellishment, because the Haggadahs that, if you even do a study of Haggadahs, even before we get into sort of social justice Haggadahs, you know, commentary on the Haggadah itself is part of the Haggadah. So just like the Talmud has marginal comments, or a rabbinic Bible, a Mikro Gadolo will have additional comments, there are different ones selected, and there's always additions. That kind of flexibility, or, you know, opportunity to personalize your interpretations, is embedded in our tradition. So what I have done, and what I want to share with you, first of all, is I'm going to talk about the plagues, the dipping of the, you know, finger into the wine for the plagues, and then the Rabbi Gamliel's statement about you cannot have completed the Passover Seder without saying three things: Pesach, Matzah, and Maror. And there's a lot of interesting things about why that is. My own personal theory is that just as prayers substituted for sacrifices once the temple was destroyed, similarly, Rabbi Gamliel is saying the statement, the saying of these things is substituting for the actual bringing of them to the temple. So I'm going to share my screen now in a minute with some things that I have in my Seder. So here we go. This is the right one. Share. Okay. So, we have our section with all the plagues that we have, and often in many situations, I think people often think, well, what can we do? How can we talk about contemporary plagues? What are the plagues that we face today? And someone earlier asked the question, you know, can we put a mask on the Seder plate? And as a symbol of a plague, and yes, you know, we can. I mean, in fact, again, Rabbi Jason showed us the origins of the Seder plate, but it's kind of almost eternally expandable for if there are things that have meaning. I would caution that at a certain point it probably becomes unwieldy, but you know, there, that would be a very reasonable thing to commemorate this plague that we have lived through this year, and the way that perhaps also how disproportionately it has been experienced, and how disproportionate has been the access to health to resolve it. How disproportionate has been the prior conditions which made some people more susceptible than others. I am very keenly aware of this right now, and I've been very lucky. No one in my family, no one I know really has died from this pandemic. I've been, you know, it's extraordinary. Over 500,000 people in this country. So that is certainly a reasonable thing to do, to focus on one of the plagues. But the other thing I thought about is this concept that you may have heard in Black Lives Matter rallies and so forth, of say their names. And I think another way we can bring that ritual that we use to talk about the plagues in the past is also as a way to remember the people who we have lost to racial injustice and police violence. And so this year I've added into my Haggadah down here on the bottom, a sort of transition, what a powerful ritual this is meant to be, 10 plagues that forced Pharaoh to see his enslaved Israelites as people, separate from his labor force, to see them as humans. Do we also need multiple plagues to shake us up so we demand change? The number of Black people killed by police should, long ago, have driven us to make sure that Black lives matter. Let us begin tonight. Let us return to our wine and say the names. And then I'm going to be asking people to, again, do the same thing with drops of wine, saying these names of the people who have been, in recent times that we've been able to have the find the names of, the documentation of, the names of people like Breonna Taylor, George Floyd, Daniel Prude, and so on. And to make that connection between the plagues of this plague of police brutality directed at Black people that at some point should make us, as it made Pharaoh, have our hearts soften and really make some real change. Okay, so the next thing I was going to do is this part, Pesach, Matzah, and Maror. And again, one of the nice things about doing my own Haggadah is I get to change it as I need to. It's kind of because I try to keep it up to date. So I actually have been teaching for some years now a course on classic Jewish texts at Fordham. And one of the pieces that we look at is a Midrash from the Mechilta, which starts with these are the ordinances of the Passover Seder, so near the end of chapter 12. And it gets into it's down here. I put it in the wrong place. Actually, no, I put it in the right place. Never mind. Gets to a discussion of the statement in the paragraph, these are the ordinances of the Passover offering. No alien shall eat from it, but your slave, your person bought for money. Once he has circumcised him, then he may eat thereof. And Rabbi Ishmael and Rabbi Eliezer debate whether, as a consequence of this, whether the he in that statement is the master or the slave. So is it saying, once you have circumcised your uncircumcised non-Israelite slave, then that non-Israelite slave can participate? Or is it saying, once you have circumcised your non-Israelite slave, then you yourself may participate? And I thought about this. I've taught this thing many years. But it was only when Rabbi, what was it? Rabbi, what's the guy in the five rabbis who tells me? When Ben Zuma, Ben Zuma explained this to me, I now got it. And I realized that what Rabbi Eliezer was saying at this point was, you can't participate in the Passover Seder if you have a non-Israelite slave in your household. Now, why would that matter? Because our Torah unfortunately permits slavery, but it permits two kinds. One is for non-Israelites, which is chattel slavery. You can pass them on as an inheritance. And there are not very many rules around the management or taking care of. But the Israelite slave is a different matter altogether. The Israelite slave can only be indentured for 6 years. And according to Deuteronomy, once you let that person leave, you must set that person up with all the wherewithal to live an independent and successful life. So it's not a real slavery situation. And we're also in our Torah, sound reasons for why someone may choose to join into that relationship. Maybe they're usually poverty, but also sometimes it's a result of a penal decision, a court decision. So what Rabbi Eliezer is saying, I believe, is how is it when he hears this is the ordinance of the Passover Seder, no alien may eat thereof, and then it brings up a slave. I think Rabbi Eliezer is saying, why is God talking about slavery when we haven't even yet left Egypt? This is chapter 12. Why is God talking about slavery when we have a chapter that both describes our departure and gives us rules for commemorating this exodus, this freedom from slavery? Why on the same day is God talking about it? And his answer is, I think it's God's telling us, if we have anybody enslaved in our household, we have no business celebrating Passover. If we are in any way responsible for the enslavement of anybody, we are hypocrites to celebrate Passover. And only when we have changed that person's condition to one where they are part of our community and we are responsible for their welfare and we are responsible for their ultimate livelihood and success, then and only then do we really have the right to sit down and take bring the Pesach offering to the temple in ancient days, or say the word Pesach in our Seder.
Great. Yeah.
Okay. So then, let me just see the next one. The matzah also gives us an opportunity to think about racial justice. There is a tradition about Abraham Ibn Ezra that says that when he was imprisoned in India, and this is this section here, he only ate matzah. And this suggested to him that matzah was the food of prisoners. Because it takes so, and it was also, he suggested it might have been the food that the Egyptians gave to the enslaved Israelites, because it took so long to digest, you could feed them a little matzah and they wouldn't want any food for much longer. Okay, so it's basically a cheap way of feeding them. And with the connection between this and where I want to go with it is the prison and the degradation of the matzah that is basically going to fill you up so you don't want more food. In most states, prisons spend $3 or less per incarcerated person on meals. As the New York Times reported just this month, of the seemingly endless tally of injustices of mass incarceration, one of the worst humiliations is food. This shadow issue, the 3,000 bologna sandwiches, mystery meats slathered on white bread, soy filler masquerading as chicken, and other culinary indignities consumed during a prison sentence, permeates life behind bars and instills a nearly universal sense of disgust. So when we eat the matzah, we might think about our complicity in the fact that people who are incarcerated, and the people who are incarcerated in this country, proportionally larger number of people of color, proportionate to their population. The overall number is still the majority of people incarcerated are white, but that's a function of the population. The majority, the highest proportion are people of color. And this is what we're feeding them. And so again, we have this responsibility to, I think, to think of that. And then with the maror, also the, I'm not even going to go into that unless I have one here. I do have one. Yes, this is actually, I do want to share this. So another one about the maror, as Rabbi Jason said earlier, has a sharpness to it. And there's a smell. Also, if we use horseradish, a stinging thing. And so like Proust Madeleine, the sharp smell of the maror, along with the stinging sensation it sends to our eyes and nose, are meant to shake our memory and our awareness and make us recall the bitterness of our enslaved ancestors. But we must also keep in mind those who are enslaved today. Incarcerated people are legally enslaved to the state as enshrined in the 13th Amendment. And as a nation, we are fighting for a just minimum wage. While we are fighting for a just minimum wage, the average minimum wage in prison in non-industry work is 93 cents per day. While the average maximum, which would be, I guess, for higher skilled work, is $4.73 a day. So again, when we're thinking about maror, we might think about these conditions that affect our Black brothers and sisters more than perhaps, certainly than many of us at our tables. And also keeping in mind that our Jewish community includes people of color, there may include among all of us, not just even people of color, all of us, people who have incarcerated family members or friends. So again, a thing to think about. So what I wanted to show here is two things. One is these ideas about how to think about the Pesach and the matzah and the maror. And secondly, to invite you to find interpretations that you think can bring the aspect of the issue of racial justice to your Seder. You have every right to plug in a paragraph into your Haggadah as much right as did Rabbi Shmuel and Rav. So I urge you to think about that. And now I'm going to turn it over to Rabbi Val.
Hello. So I wanted to share something also from an entirely different era. We've had the ancient and the rabbinic and the more modern and other rabbinic. I'm gonna do a quick screen share. Okay. Oops, that's not the one I wanted. There we go. I have a question for everybody before I share this. When I talk about this section called Pour Out Your Wrath or Shafuch Chamatcha, raise your hand if you did this growing up or do this part of the Haggadah at your own Seder, just with a show of hands. Okay.
I do a modified version.
Uh-huh.
Not as written.
Got it. Okay. Well, I never did it growing up. I did not know what it was. It was completely not in the Reform Haggadah. There was a slight allusion to some of the ideas. Very, very modified. So I didn't know about it until I went to rabbinical school because it had just been gotten rid of. But it's something that I guess this year became really curious about for the first time. And for me, it is somewhat related to our times. Let's read it. I'm going to give you a little historical context for it and then give you some of the things that I'm thinking about related to racial justice. So could I get a volunteer to read the translation, starting with poor? Rachel, would you be able to do that? Starting right here. Could you unmute your device first if you're able to do this? Or just give me a wave and say, no, you can't do it. Okay. Rachel, you're muted. Okay. All right. Let's have somebody else do that.
Can I try it now? Because I think
yes, please. Go for it.
Thanks. Pour your wrath upon the nations that did not know you and upon the kingdoms that did not call upon your name. Since they have consumed Yaakov and laid waste his habitation, Psalm 79:6-7, pour out your fury upon them and the fierceness of your anger shall reach them, Psalm 69:25. You shall pursue them with anger and eradicate them from under the skies of the Lord, from Lamentations 3:66.
Right. So it's not really a prayer. It's kind of an incantation and it's taken from passages from the Tanakh, from the Bible. And we believe that it entered into the Haggadah in probably the 12th century. Although it's not entirely clear. So what was happening in the 12th century for Jews, and this started like in Germany and the Rhineland and like Eastern France?
Pogroms.
Life wasn't so good.
The Crusades.
The Crusades, absolutely. Like the Crusades really brought around this new horrible destruction. And one of the rabbis who alludes to it early on that's recorded, his wife was murdered in front of him in the Crusades. So many Jews were experiencing just utter terror, degradation. Here they are trying to celebrate Pesach. And, you know, this is the time of year when they're always attacked around Easter time and the blood libel is thrown at them. And they're trying to kind of think about freedom and going from degradation to freedom, but they're feeling stuck in degradation. And so, you know, they have kind of this, I think this fantasy response born out of their just humiliation, their sense of powerlessness, their inability to really feel the emotions of the Haggadah in some ways. They they call on God, who is the only power they feel like can protect them, to pour out wrath upon these non-Jews who've been attacking them. You know, in our own time, this is, it can be a very, very uncomfortable passage. There is also this kind of corollary passage that many people read called pour out your love. You know, or some people, from what I hear, only read it in Hebrew, no translation at all, so nobody really knows what's happening, or it's expunged entirely, like it was in the Haggadahs that I grew up with. But I want to kind of come back to it. I mean, I feel like for myself, I'm reclaiming it for myself in a certain way, because I never had it before. Because we're living in a time with this kind of reawakened awareness of real racial, such an obvious racial inequality, right?
People.
And I feel like as Jews, one of the things that we often find difficult is that there is this feeling a sense of our own kind of degradation and our own victimization. And now, you know, kind of grappling for sure with the victimization of people of color. I think there's sometimes this tension for us about, you know, that we, as Jews, and many, many of us Jews are, you know, not white, but many of us are. I am white. So I'm, you know, really thinking about my own, you know, kind of the historical attacks on my people. And in some ways, I think I'm better able to understand the suffering of people of color because of that. Occasionally, I feel like I become defensive, right? Many of you guys read the book that we read as part of our, you know, the summer reading group, and that made many of us feel terribly defensive. It was just extremely hard reading because we came to see our own complicitness, our own complicity, right? So I've been really kind of struggling with this passage, and here are some thoughts that I have. I would say my thoughts are not entirely complete. I'm still kind of working through this. One of the things that I see here is when we call on God to pour out wrath on the people who are oppressing us, we are giving vent to a very, very real anger and fear. And a legitimate anger and fear. One of the things that I think is really important is to be able to express that and not shy away from it. I feel like, you know, those who expunge this passage, you know, there is like a real discomfort with it, but I also feel like being able to express the rage or at least hear it from times past can be very helpful, because I think that can spur us to make change, right? It gives us fuel. Information and fuel. So I do think it's worth hearing and listening to, and especially when it can help us hear and listen to the pain that's being experienced by people of color in our nation. It's bitter. It's a very bitter kind of expression. And I think as we think of this, this happens right before we're about to open the door for Elijah, right? Which is, Elijah is this symbol of redemption. We're really hoping, will this year be the year that we finally achieve redemption? Whenever we evoke Elijah, or it's like, can this be the time when we have a final redemption? So, you know, we're expressing this very, very dark, these very dark feelings just before hoping for this wonderful redemption. And I think there can be more than one different kind of redemption. There can be a real destructive redemption, like an end of days, you know, the end time sort of thinking, or a kind of a utopia. And I think that's in some ways what we're experiencing now as Americans, right? The rhetoric right now is, there's a lot of disagreement about the rhetoric and the tactics that can be used to make Black lives really matter, right? There, are we grappling with, are we really talking about the destruction of the institutions like police, health kind of processes, the budget of the United States of America, our military, right? Or are we talking about changing them? So there are sort of two different visions of what can happen to that. A kind of a catastrophic change or a slow change, which I think all of us are kind of thinking about. And I think as we, you know, look at this pour out your wrath passage, we can think about, do we want to have an utter destruction of, I probably wouldn't say the people who are doing wrong, but the values that lead to that, you know, pour out. I feel like it would be, it's worth it to talk at our Seders about what values would we love to have would we love to have God utterly destroy in our nation? What are the values that we want destroyed? Mm-hmm. What are the values that we would like to have live on? Many people at this point in the Seder, some people I'm told, somebody whose Syrian husband's family, she was telling me, you know, when they take out the drops for the plagues, in this custom, instead of using their pinky and getting little tiny drops, they really pour out little pours of wine into a container. They pour all of that together into a cup and they go outdoors and they actually pour it onto the ground so that they're pouring out this destruction. And it's almost like the opposite of what the words are saying. It's like we're getting rid of that. We're getting rid of the destructive, degrading values that exist among us. It's a kind of a cathartic process, almost like a tashlich of Passover. And that's something that I'm very interested in exploring doing and, inviting my guests to think about, what do we want to pour out? What do we want to get rid of? What do we want to leave behind, and how to rebuild anew? As we look forward to Elijah's entering.
So you've gotten out from four of us some ideas of ways to manage certain parts of the Seder. And as I said again, you know, there's no obligation to read straight through from start to end in Hebrew with nobody understanding. You know, I mean, that you really can make it, it is meant to be an interactive discussion-based meal, like the symposium, with those questions that are posed. So I'm going to put in the chat a link to three different places that have sources for Haggadah supplements and Haggadahs. Okay, so these are three supplements. I don't know why the first one isn't in. It should actually be three sites. I think the third one, if it's not, I think if that's not coming up as a website, let me actually pull up the site and then I will copy that and yes, this is what it is. Here it is. I mean, okay, so this is actually the third one. So these are various sites that offer you tools for adding to your Seder, replacing your Haggadah, augmenting your Haggadah, substituting for your Haggadah. And most social justice, Jewish social justice organizations are now sending your inbox and your email their supplements for this year. They're usually very timely and focused on the immediate concerns of that organization. And there's some wonderful resources. The one I want to start with first though, is actually not a Passover Haggadah, but a Haggadah that the Jews of Color Caucus from JFRIJ, Jews for Racial and Economic Justice, an organization that I'm very involved in, did for Juneteenth. And the reason why I want to bring this up is because it does two things. Number one, this Haggadah was not meant to be used on Passover. It does speak to the power of the Passover Haggadah to commemorate other kinds of oppression. And it also speaks to the desire of Jews who are Black to ritualize Jewishly this Juneteenth event. And it's an important thing for us to see, I think, because that's one place where I really, as my hope with our anti-racism task force, is to help us start to really integrate Black experience and Jewish experience, because they are integrated. There are many people for whom this is one and the same. And so I wanted to share a little bit of this, just a little bit, and then a couple examples of things that you can get from some of these sites, and then we'll do questions. So here is the Jews for Racial and Economic Justice Haggadah for Black Lives. Oh, no, this is actually different. Sorry, this is not it. This is, no, wrong one. Sorry. Wrong screen share. Let me start again. Hold on, stop that. It's a different one. I wanted this one, yes. Okay, sorry. So this was just to show an example, it's basically, it begins with the different stages of, as we move from degradation to redemption, another model of that. It continues with blessings. It continues with cups, the four cups, which are connected to the four statements by Akura Shikra. I think I'm saying her, yeah, Asata Shukur. It is our duty to fight for our freedom. It is our duty to win. We must love and protect one another. We have nothing to lose but our chains. Taking on the four cups of our Haggadah. And then also a Seder plate with commemorative foods that relate to the history. Elijah and Miriam's bowls to relate to the African background of the drinking cup. And then a magid, which is, I'm just gonna go here when it comes into it, of telling stories about people's lives. Let me see if I can find this, where it is. No, it's not there. It may actually not be in the Haggadah itself, because I think people read their stories, but it was a commemoration by telling stories of people who are enslaved or freed from slavery. Anyway, so that just to show it as an example of like really the power of what we can do with this document. But some of the other things that are worth also looking at are examples like, for example, here's one from the Prage from the Freedom Seder, which was Arthur Waskaz and the Shalom. Oh, come on, Vera. I don't want that here. I don't want that there. It will come. This is what I wanted, yes. So he takes the section, the four children, and changes it to a series of questions that can be questions that we might ask ourselves about, rather than asking what are the laws and statutes of the Passover Seder, ask ourselves questions. What are the tactics and strategies that I should use? I don't see myself represented and don't hear my stories. How can I reflect my identity? How can I acknowledge my privilege and help elevate voices of marginalized people? I'm so scared of being called a racist. What do I do about conversations about race? taking those same questions and the characters of those four children and using them in this context. So that's one might thing you might find if you go and use one of these, the searches, is that freedom, the freedom Seder. Another one, another one is one from the Black Lives Matter, also Jay Fridge thing. Anyway, I don't want to actually go too much longer because we're going long in time. So I'm just going to say that you can use these sites, and you can, the one that's the Haggadah.com, it's the social justice option, in that they have a whole lot of them, but the social justice option will take you to a variety of Haggadahs that people have composed to give us a way to take this format and use it to think and to provoke us to think differently. And that's what I hope that we will do. I hope that you will all be encouraged to do and feel free to do when we go forward on our Passovers this coming in a couple of weeks. So I'm going to close with that. I don't know if anybody has any questions. We have a little bit more time, but thank you all for coming.
I did have a question. Am I still unmuted or am I muted?
We can hear you.
Okay. I wanted to ask Sam, Rabbi Sam, because I think you're right that this, something happened this time with George Floyd that was different. And I would like to know, I know this isn't a Passover question, but it seems like a good place to ask it, because I really would like to know what happened that made it different? What made us feel more than we had felt before? I mean, everybody, maybe not everybody, I mean, I think I've tried to feel a lot, but there was something different. And I'd like to know what anybody around here thinks what changed.
For me, it was, first of all, the utter explicitness. And secondly, I know that Rabbi Sam used the word humiliation, and I appreciate why you say that. I think for me, it was, I didn't experience that George Floyd was humiliated, but that there was an attempt to humiliate, and that there was a diabolical detachment on the part of the police officer of what he was doing. He couldn't have cared less. And I think just being faced with that, that was me. I'm just speaking for me.
Another thing related to that was the also the complicity that standing around him while that particular cop with a smirk on his face was killing this man who was begging for his life, the others stood around and reminded all of us, we saw them, I think reminded all of us that we stand around far too much when we shouldn't, when we should intervene, when we should stop, when we should tell that person not to tell the racist joke or make that racist comment, we stand away and let it happen. So mm-hmm. I think that was part of it too.
I think mm-hmm. that's true. I just want to bring it back. Amy and I have, I very much appreciated this, by the way, because we've had our own Haggadah for a number of years, and we always like to add inserts. For me, I think it was not only the diabolical, but what you said, the complete indifference. And that also has a relationship to the Israelites in slavery, the complete indifference of the Egyptians. If I'm right, the Egyptians never thought of anything other than the Israelites. They were always the Israelites, they weren't individual people. And so one of the things that I'm trying to stress this year is that that's not acceptable. That's not something we should do. And the last thing I want to say is we also, I think there's a great relationship. When we say the traditional Dayenu at Passover, we follow it up with a much more contemporary version of Dayenu about what will be enough. And, you know, if we can support the environment, if we can think of ways to do, if we do all those things, it will and will not be enough. So I'm going to incorporate some of those things into our Haggadah, but I appreciate what everybody said tonight.
I'd like to just, because you raised the question of how this was different, and it's really interesting to participate and suddenly be faced with the reality. I have to think what is different, and it comes to mind very quickly. I had nightmares years ago of being utterly naked in a crowd. And the shame that I felt, I was totally powerless and totally ashamed and humiliated in myself. And what comes to mind as you asked that question was the utter brutal nakedness of the worst of human experience that we could watch for minutes. Billions could watch this together. And I realize that many could avert their eyes and not see it, as humans do all the time, as the Nazis did. But being forced to confront that reality, that this is naked, naked, awful human capacity, was of a quality and a dimension and a magnitude that never before had been so utterly presented to the large mass of humanity around the globe. And I think that was a qualitative difference of that moment as compared to other horrors of moments that existed. And that's my reaction to your question.
Thanks.
Yeah, I think, I just want to say, I think what Barra said is really important. You know, there was, in a way, it was almost like a theater setting, you know, and the other officers were there to sort of represent the silent onlooker. I mean, you couldn't have staged it more dramatically. But I also think another element was, you know, I think Floyd's innocence was also very powerful, and his helplessness, even though he's a huge guy, his helplessness, his innocence came across really strongly. And, you know, I think for a lot of white Americans, if people have been very involved with issues, like, you know, some people on the screen tonight, it's not news. But I think many white Americans had a certain distance from the whole thing, and that really sort of, at least for the days around it, and I hope until today, it really sort of eviscerated that distance and brought people really close to it. But I just had one more thought, which is, you know, as I think about it now, you know, as I said, when I start my Haggadah, we start our Haggadahs, our Seders, we do try to ask people questions more or less, you know, how's your life different than it was last year? And given the last year we have, you know, usually that's just kind of, that can be seen as sort of a polite rhetorical question. But given what we've all been through in the last year, I would encourage people to use that approach, but think about it very specifically. What do you want to draw out for people? I mean, I raised some questions around racial justice, but I think it's very interesting for people. Mm-hmm. I think people should share how their lives are different, how their thinking is different than last Seder. But you probably want to guide that conversation more than usual, just because of the drasticness with which our lives have changed.
Mm-hmm. Can I add one more thing, Robert? And first of all, thank you for that. I actually was planning to do that, but you lent an angle to it that's very helpful to me. I just wanted to make a point about the police officers who were complicit. There's a lot of, there's more shades, I think a little bit more nuance to that also, which is differently troubling, which is my understanding is at least one of the officers tried in some capacity to push back. And the power of that person, of whatever, I forgot, I can't even think of his, Charles, whatever we pronounce his name, was so, and the hierarchy of the police, you know, was such that he could only push back a little bit, or felt that he could only push back a little bit. Happened to be a police officer of color also. Mm-hmm. And so I just think that's important, not just to document, but just because there are ways and there are gradations here that we might all feel complicit and trying a little of this and a little of that. And, you know, it's going to take more than that to stop somebody's knee from being on somebody's neck.
Yeah, you know, I just have it in my brain. I know we have to wrap up, but, you know, when I teach, like, especially biblical narratives to the kids in Hebrew school, I always ask them to try to put themselves in the heart and mind of each character. It might be a useful exercise here. You know, you've got the three fellow officers. You have Chauvin, or whatever his name is, the one who murdered him. You have Floyd. You have the person taking the film, you know, and to try to assign those roles? I don't know. It might be an interesting exercise. Because I think, although I see Barra's point in the chat bar, yes, it is true. We saw some of the others murdered as well. But somehow this exploded in a way that I don't think the others have.
I would like to suggest that part of the reason exploded differently was, of course, the content that everybody has talked about, the nature of the murder, but also the situation that everyone was in. There were so many people who did not have a job to go to, right, or college to attend, or anything else better to do. I think that is why people got out in the streets and were active about it. And I worry that had it happened at any other time, you know, the response would have been pretty much the same as to all these other dozens of murders. I think it's an important thing to remember, like, do we really have better things to do than this? I don't, you know, like, always remember.
Yeah, I've been thinking about that a lot. I used to think before this summer when we got on the streets was, you know, those countries where, like, you know, where people just stop work. They don't go to school. They stop going. And I was just thinking, like, during the 4 years of the Trump administration, like, asking myself, why am I, like, not just saying, no, it stops. Business as usual stops. We need to get in the streets. And we did it to some extent. But you're right, Val. Like, we have not... collectively, we haven't yet decided that this is the most important thing. And well, we need to do that.
But we did get rid of Trump. And I think that a lot of the energy of what was happening this summer helped that happen.
I also think there was a snowballing effect. I think one thing that was really powerful to me that was different to me was just seeing so many people really paying attention, and that made me feel more empowered to do something about it, that something could change. And so I think, I don't know, the more that we keep doing these things, if we're bringing these ideas into our Seder and making issues visible and normal to talk about around our family and friends, hopefully we can keep some of that momentum going.
When is the next?
You would like to join the task force. you should definitely email Bronwyn and say you want to join it. Mm-hmm. And if you're a man, that's even better, because right now we're all women.
And when is our next? Don't we have another meeting of this?
I think we don't have one scheduled next, so we should do that.
I thought we had the 18th or the 22nd as a second meeting of this type. No, I'm wrong. I can take those days off my calendar.
I think so.
Okay.
The comment that it was an opportunistic, perhaps liberal backlash is very interesting. That everyone was on vacation, everyone was not working, COVID has stopped. Is that why it says Tzedek twice you shall pursue? That we don't forget it, that we have to be reminded twice, Tzedek, you idiots. It's not something you do sometimes.
Look, I love that. That's a good point to end on, I think.
I was going
to
say the same thing. It's a great point to end on, yes. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Nathan.
Thank you, guys. It's brilliant.
Okay, yep. Thank you.
Well, all, and stay safe.
Take it in.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you, Bronwyn. Thank you, Barra.
Hey.
Hey.
Yeah, I think it went well. Thank you.
Yeah, I think it's
forgot to ask about the recording, but
Oh, yeah, it's okay. Yeah. No, I think people left with a lot, so.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.